Good morning, everyone. I want to welcome everyone back to our legal holiday shiur series. We have the great privilege this morning of hosting Rabbi Shai Schefter, who has joined us in the past, and is Baruch Hashem joining us again. I want to begin by thanking all of our co-sponsors, Dina and Saul Kazovitz, who are sponsoring in memory of Dina's father, Avi Blumenfeld, Avram Yosef, and Yisrael Shalom, Zichron Levracha, Mindy and Henry Orlinsky, in honor of Rav Shai Schefter Shlita, and Nechama and Danny Sachs, in memory of Danny's father, Aaron Usher Zelig ben Yaakov Yitzchak, Zichron Levracha. In the parsha that we read yesterday, we read that, of course, the Beis Yaakov, Yaakov and his family, the total of 70 members of the family, head down to Mitzrayim. But we read that before the rest of the family comes down, before the entire family comes down, there's a vanguard that's sent in advance. The Torah tells us in a Parashas paragraph above Pasuk Ches, Yehuda is sent as a vanguard in order to make way for the rest of Klal Yisrael. And Rashi, citing a Medrash Tanchuma in Vayigash Siman Yud Aleph, says that it wasn't just to scout the territory and to start setting up camp, but rather it was lahaskin lo beis talmud. It was to set up a beis medrash from which there would be a hora'ah that would be dispersed to Yisrael. There would be a place for psak halacha that was set up in Mitzrayim so that Klal Yisrael would indeed have a place to look to for guidance on all halachic matters. That's really all that Rashi quotes from the medrash. But the truth is the medrash continues. And the medrash actually quotes a strange proof to this notion that Yehuda was sent to set up a beis talmud. It says, Teda lechu shehu kein, kiven shehalach Yosef me'etzlo hayodeya be'eze perek piresh mimenu. The Medrash Tanchuma references another Medrash that appears earlier in the Parsha, the Medrash that says that the wagons that Yosef sent to Yaakov Avinu was actually a subtle reference to the final Torah sugya that they had learned together. They had been studying the sugya of Egla Arupa. So Yosef sends these agalos, these wagons, and in a play on words, the word agala sounds like the word Egla. He references to Yaakov the last sugya that they had learned. The Medrash says, that's how you know that Yaakov Avinu sent Yehuda to set up a base Talmud in Mitzrayim in Goshen. Medrash doesn't really explain how one relates to the other. It seems like a bit of a non sequitur. It certainly doesn't explain how Yosef's message, his subtle message through the Agalos, proves that Yaakov was sending Yosef to set up a base Talmud. What I would suggest, what perhaps the Medrash is really trying to communicate, is that Yaakov realized the moment that he saw those wagons from Yosef, that what sustained Yosef in a foreign culture, in a foreign society, what kept him true to his values, to the values of his family, to Torah, was that single Torah conversation that he had with his father. Yaakov Avinu realized that if his progeny, if Klal Yisrael were going to survive this lengthy galus in which they were immersed in a foreign culture and they were subject to its persecutions as well, the only way they were going to do so was through commitment to Torah. The Medrash itself says when Yehuda went to set up a base Talmud, it wasn't only Sheyehei Morasham Hora'ah. It wasn't only because they needed Psak Halacha. It wasn't only because when Klal Yisrael had a question about their pots and pans, when they had a question about Zmanei Tvila, they would have somebody to call. But the Medrash also says, it goes further than Rashi, it says, Sheyehei Melamed Es HaShvatim. It was a place for them to learn Torah as well. It wasn't enough to ask the occasional Shaila. They were going to survive the Galus Mitzrayim. They needed to be learning Torah as well. But to me, this Medrash deeply speaks to the shiur that we are having this morning on several levels. Number one, as always, I really do congratulate everybody by making sure that part of their holiday weekend, that their holiday weekend starts with Torah. Secular holidays are nice. They give us an opportunity to spend more time with our families and the like. But if they're not rooted and first anchored in Torah, then we're largely missing the point. If it's just a time for leisure, then we've missed an opportunity. And it's always good to make sure that our legal holidays start with Limud HaTorah together. And number two, I think it's also appropriate for the topic and speaker that we have this morning. Rabbi Schefter is going to speak this morning about faces of anti-Semitism and our complicated relationship with Hashem. And I would argue that, and I argue, this is something akin to what I spoke about this past Friday night at our Oneg, that the first step in combating anti-Semitism is making sure that we are rooted in who we are, and we are connected to what we stand for, and that we're rooted in Torah, we understand who we are, and that we have that inner confidence to face the world outside. It's really being rooted in that base Talmud, that from which we are melamed es hashvatim, that we are melamed klal Yisrael, that we are able to combat and face the outside world. And I think Rabbi Schefter is somebody who's really at the forefront of doing so. Rabbi Schefter, through his work in Woodmere, in my hometown, and beyond, is somebody who ensures that our Bate Knesses are not just Bate Knesses, they are also Bate Talmud. It is not enough for our shuls to be just a place where we congregate to daven, just a place where we happen to have a minyan here or there. You can do that in a backyard, you can do that in a basement. It's key. He's been critical in ensuring that our Batei Knesses are also Batei Talmud, that our shuls and our rabbanim are not just people that we call with an occasional shayla, but are places where we go to learn and to grow and to strengthen our connection with the Ribono Shel Olam. In the true spirit of Es Yehuda Shalach Lefanav, Rabbi Schefter has always been ahead of the curve on that front, really, again, been doing transformative work in his community, in my home community, and really beyond. And it has been a great bliss for us over the course of our legal holiday series to have Rabbi Schefter, somebody who teaches us Torah as well. So without further ado, it is a great bliss to hear from Rabbi Schefter Shlita.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Rabbi Schreier. It is really always a kavod and a bliss to be here. And when Henry had first asked me to come, I think it was probably 5 years ago already, or 6 years ago, on the first legal holiday that I was introduced to this community, I said, well, am I going to schlep out? But I have to say, I thank you for having me on a legal holiday. This morning, the traffic was only 39 minutes, which is really, and I did not speed at all. And that really, it's phenomenal. So I thank you for all coming out here and coming out in particular to learn Torah together and to inspire each other. Thank you to all of those who sponsored this morning. And all the Tomchei HaTorah, you should know that you are what keep all of the wonderful activities of this shul going. And it's a schus for you, for your families, and for the entire community. So I thank you, along with everyone else who thanks you, for being here together and for providing these kinds of opportunities. So Bershus HaRabbanim, it's, as I said, really a great kavod as always. And I always feel uncomfortable because whenever they ask me to come, I think I'm always here on January 1st. But whenever I'm asked to come, I'm always lumped together with two people who I consider friends, but who are also mentors to me, Rabbi Ari Leibowitz and Rabbi Daniel Stein, who are always somehow, we're a trio. So I thank you all for coming out, even though you've heard the other two great speakers. And please indulge me. I really am blessed to be a part of this very, very special group. So there's a medrash where we're told about a fascinating conversation that took place between Matrona Achas, which means a aristocratic woman, and Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta, one of the greatest of the Tanoim. And they were having a conversation. And what were they talking about? She turns to this great Tana and she says, L'kama yamim bara HaKadosh Baruch Hu es olam. How many days did it take the Ribono Shel Olam to create the world? And he turns to her, very surprised, and he says, we all know what it says in Chumash. Sheshes yamim asa Hashem asa shamayim v'asa aretz. So what are you asking? So she says, okay, if we're all in agreement that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created the world in 6 days and on the seventh day he rested, me'oz v'ad ata mahu osa. It's been a very long time since those 6 days of creation. So if everything was set in motion then, what has God been busy with ever since? And Rabbi Yossi ben Chalafta responds and he says that since that time, what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been busy with was, he is bona sulamos. Male lazeh, Umeirim lazeh, mashpi lazeh, umeirim lazeh. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been building ladders. And some people are being placed on the top of the ladder and others somewhere on the bottom. And that's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu has been busy with. This is the story of the Medrash that has troubled me over the years. Wasn't sure exactly what it meant. But I think when you consider what the Medrash is teaching us, I think what it means is that we as a community and certainly we as individuals find ourselves on very different points of that ladder in our connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu at different stages of our lives. It's the same way in every relationship. There are ups, there are downs, there are times when we feel closer, times when we feel a little bit less connected. But that's the reality of relationships. And it's the reality of our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu as well. That we have different times when we feel very differently about where we stand in the context of HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our lives and us in his life as well, Kabayachal. And that is so much of what we need to think about, of that relationship that is always in motion, that is always in flux, that sometimes maybe we feel on top and other times maybe somewhere in the middle, at some points in our lives maybe on the bottom. And perhaps this is something to think about as we will try to develop the theme of today's conversation. We'll get back to this a little bit in the end, but I think it's something to think about, that we all have those points in our lives when we feel very differently about what the relationship represents for us and what it means to have HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our lives. It is no secret that we're living through a time here in the United States where we feel a tremendous sense the uptick of anti-Semitism. This is not news to any of us. For anyone who's been following the trends and all that's been going on, anything that's been written, we're all very well aware. And it's disheartening, and it's very disappointing, and it's very upsetting. And we're all having meetings with our local government officials, and we're all trying to do whatever we can to advocate for our community's rights, for our ability to feel safe. All of that is very nice, but that's all terrifying. And we're not here to talk about negativity. You didn't need someone from out of town to bring more negativity to any community. We all have enough of it. So why are we here? What are we talking about? I think this also has given us an opportunity with hateful intimidation, with targeted anti-Semitism, with all that we see. I think perhaps it can give us a positive opportunity as well. Maybe this is the first time in some of our lives where we are given the opportunity to actually talk to ourselves, talk to our spouses, to talk to our children, or to talk to our grandchildren about what it means to be singled out, about what it means to be the Yam HaNivchar. You're being singled out by other people in the world. Think about what it means to be singled out. Think about how special you are. Think about the fact that we refer to ourselves as the Yam Segula, as the Yam HaNivchar. And maybe at times in our lives, we don't think about that because we take it for granted that we have built communities, that we are thriving, that we're doing very well in general. But here, now that we have the opportunity to think about what it means to be targeted, what it means to be different, maybe it's something special and something very positive as well, along with all of the complicated issues that, of course, we need to face and we need to think about. But this is an aspect that should not be lost on any of us. We say it every day in our davening. Baruch Hu Elokeinu Shebaranu Lechvoda, as Rabbi Schreier so beautifully said, this is what it means to target anti-Semitism. The first step is to recognize who we are and what we represent, what we stand for. What is our standing in the world? What is our position? We say it every day in the davening. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu, B'hiddi lanu min atoim, B'nasan lanu Torah semes, B'chaye olam nata b'sofeinu. Every day in the end of davening, we say as well, Aleinu l'shabeach la'adon hakol. We declare with pride that we praise HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Why? What are we so thankful for? What are we grateful about? It's because Shalo asanu kegoye ha'aratzos. It's something I'm proud of. It's something I'm not ashamed of. It's something I hold as a badge of honor. Shalo asanu kegoye ha'aratzos. There are so many distinctions between the way I think and the way others think, the way I live and the way others live, the way I behave and the way others behave, the way I interact with my employees and with my employer and the way others might. And I'm proud of those distinctions. That is what makes me different. And that is what makes me unique. When you think about it, the term is thrown around very often that we are supposed to be the Am HaNivchar. We're supposed to be the Or LaGoyim. What exactly does it mean to be the Am HaNivchar or to be the Or LaGoyim? You ever think about it? So where's the first time that the Jewish people as a community are referred to as the Am Segula, the Am HaNivchar? Where is it? By Kabbalah Satora, where HaKadosh Baruch Hu singles us out. And then on that occasion, he says, V'atem tiyu li mamleches ka'anim v'goy kadosh. You are going to be unique, you're going to be separate, and you are going to be a mamleches ka'anim v'goy kadosh. How strange. My father is not a Kohen. My grandfather is not a Kohen. So what is the expectation? What does it mean when HaKadosh Baruch Hu says that he singles me out and he wants me and all of us to be serving as Kohanim in the world? How are we supposed to do that? How is that relevant to somebody who's born into a family of regular Jews who are not Kohanim? Those of us who are not privileged, who are not blessed to have that special gift of being a Kohen, of being from that family. So what does it mean to be a Mamlechas Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh? Perhaps when we think about it, the Gemara Maseches Kiddushin has a discussion. What exactly is the role of a Kohen when we have a Beis HaMikdash? Obviously, that is when a Kohen holds the most significant post in the history of Kohanim. Of course, Kohanim today get the first Aliyah, and the Gemara Maseches Gittin says we're supposed to make the Kohen go first for everything that we have. But in general, the highlight of the lifetime of a Kohen is when he has the opportunity to serve in the Beis HaMikdash. So the Gemara has a discussion. Who exactly is the Kohen representing? Does the Kohen represent Shlucha Didan? Is he the representative of the community? Or is he a Shlucha Derachmana? Is he the representative of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? Either way, whichever way you assume that he's shlucha didan or shlucha de rachmana, whether he represents HaKadosh Baruch Hu or he represents us, there is one job that the Kohen is given. Of course, there are many particulars that are involved in that job, and the whole Maseches Zvachim and Menachos and so many other sugyas and shas talk about exactly how a Kohen needs to do his job in the Beis HaMikdash, how the avodah is supposed to be done, what will disqualify him from doing the avodah. All of that aside, when you boil it down and you try to figure out what is the essence of the job of a Kohen, the answer is his job is to serve as the bridge between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and the Jewish people. His job, like the Rambam says, Kvodo v'Sefarto, the pride of a Kohen is that he has the opportunity to live his entire life in the Beis HaMikdash, focused only on spiritual matters, and he brings that all down, either from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, or he connects the people to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But that really is the job of the Kohen, to serve as that link, to serve as that bridge, to be the one who connects and unites spiritual matters with all the matters that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. Those of us who are living life, who are going out to work, who are engaging with the world, doing whatever we do, show up in the Beis HaMikdash, engage with the Kohen, and have the opportunity to then be connected with HaKadosh Baruch Hu himself. And that, perhaps, is what it means when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tells all of us that we have the ability and we have the opportunity to serve in the experience of our lives as the Mamleches Kohanim V'Goy Kadosh. What does it mean to be the Am Segula? It means when you live in a world where there is such a dearth of spirituality, where there is such a lack of appreciation for the values that we stand for, it's an opportunity to serve as a body of people who are a Mamleches Kohanim, a body of people who know how to unite, who know how to connect, who know how to serve as that bridge between spiritual matters and all that the mundane world has put in front of us. That is our job. To be an Orla Goyim does not mean that we teach the world how to keep Shabbos. It's not relevant to them. Goy she Shabbos Chayim Misa. It doesn't mean that we teach them about Taras HaMishpacha or about Kashrus. It's totally irrelevant to the lives that we live. What it does mean is to give perspective and to give value to what the experience of life is all about. To serve as the Shlucha D'Rachmana or the Shlucha D'Idan. To be the one who knows how to bridge and how to unite some kind of very significant meaning to the experience of life and what we as human beings can take out of the great gift of life that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has given all of us. It's interesting that we've all heard the term that we are the Orla Goyim, the light unto the nations. And it's something that many Jews have spoken about, but where does it stem from? Where does that title come from? It's actually a pasuk in the Navi Yeshaya, where he refers to the Jewish people as the Orla Goyim. What does it mean to be the Orla Goyim? So I finally decided to look up in the Navi Yeshaya. I was really looking for the Mefarshim. What do they say? But then look in the Pasuk. You don't have to look in the Mefarshim. The Pasuk itself, if you finish it off, you have an understanding of what it means to be the Orla Goyim. The Navi Yeshaya says as follows, Ve'atzarcha ve'atencha lebris am le'or ha-goyim. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has made a covenant with us, and we are supposed to be the Orla Goyim. Everyone stops there. Very next Pasuk. What does it mean to be the Orla Goyim? Lifkoach einayim ivrus. To open up the eyes of those who are walking around, who are living life blinded, who just don't have perspective. That's what it means to be the Orla Goyim. To be people who have the ability to give perspective, who have the ability to see greater value in all that goes on in the experience of life. Lifkoach einayim ivrus. It's the words of the Nabi Yeshaya himself. And the reason why this is so complicated is because we are all torn. We are all pulled in so many different directions. My father once told me from Rav Soloveitchik, I'm sure it's written somewhere, I just don't remember where. I think Rav Soloveitchik has it written himself in English. But it was a fascinating insight to me. We say it in Hallel, maybe we never thought about it. When David HaMelech tells us, Ani amarti b'chapsi kal ha'adam kozeh. How do you translate that phrase? What does it mean? So we have our friends here from Haifa who speak a good Hebrew. What does it mean? Kal ha'adam kozeh. Every man is a liar? Is deceitful? Is that the way we live life? We believe that? That would be very hard to experience all of life walking around. And every person we interact with, we believe, kal ha'adam kozeh. I have to be suspicious of everyone. Now, there are some people who live life like that. I don't live life like that. Maybe I'm too believing. I'm too trusting. I don't know. Maybe I'm naive. But you can't live when you have that perspective. When you think that everyone who's having a conversation with you is not telling you the truth. When you're suspicious of everything you ever hear. When you're just involved in conspiracy theories. And that's the way you're caught up in your... So what does it mean? Kal ha'adam kozev. What does David HaMelech mean? Rav Soloveitchik explains so beautifully that perhaps it means that every person is intrinsically conflicted. Every person has two very different value systems that are pulling at them at all times. And he explains as follows. The Medrash says that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam HaRishon, the very first human being, Afar Min HaAdama. Now we know, as the people who study Chumash, we are very well aware of the fact that there is a concept called the Hey HaYidia. When you have a Hey in the beginning of a word, it highlights something extra special, very significant, something different, something unique. So what does it mean, as the Medrash, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu created Adam, mean HaAdama, from the earth? What is the earth? What's so special? Which earth? Where did HaKadosh Baruch Hu create Adam HaRishon from? And the Medrash has two opinions. Rav Soloveitchik suggested maybe it's not a dispute in the Medrash, maybe it's not a machlokas, but rather both of them are true. So the first opinion in the Medrash is HaKadosh Baruch Hu took Afar Min HaAdama, from the most holy and consecrated ground, which is the Har HaBayis. HaKadosh Baruch Hu went to the place that is referred to in Chumash as Mizbach Adama Ta'asali, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us to make a Mizbeah and put it there in that very holy place. That is where the Ribono Shel Olam took the dirt, took the dust to create Adam HaRishon from. That's the first opinion in the Medrash. And from there, he infused Adam HaRishon with Nishmas Chaim, and out came Adam HaRishon. The second opinion of the Medrash is no. We were not created from the Har HaBayis, but rather, Savar Afaro Mikol Ruchos HaAdam. HaKadosh Baruch Hu took a little sampling of dirt from the Arba Kantos HaAretz, from all over the world, put it all together, and from that was created Adam HaRishon. Rav Soloveitchik suggested that perhaps both are correct, and we are all created with both of those perspectives and with both of those foundations. On the one hand, at our core, we all feel intrinsically connected to Afar Min HaAdama, to the Makam HaMikdash, to the Mizbeach, to spiritual matters. It's who we are in our essence, at our core. It's what defines us. At the same time, HaKadosh Baruch Hu created us to be very cosmopolitan, to be universal people, to be interested in all kinds of things. You ever wonder, you see on the news that something happened in South Korea. Do you know anybody in South Korea? Why does it interest you? Why are you interested in what's going on in South Korea? The answer is because it's part of who we are, that we are a universal body of people who care about things outside of our own Dalet Amos. That's the nature of who we are, because we were created Me'arba Ruchos HaAdama. And that is something that is innate to all of us, to have an interest, to be curious, to want to be involved, to want to contribute, to want to invest, to want to engage. But both of those are true. And as a result of that, Rav Soloveitchik said, sometimes we are torn about where our fundamental allegiance lies. On the one hand, we have a foundation of Afar Min HaAdama, from the Makam HaMizbeach, from the Migdash, from the holiest place. On the other hand, we also have a foundation which is universal, which is very far from Makam HaMikdash. And that, he suggested, is what it means. In some way, we are all living a bifurcated life. In some way, we are all living this dynamic where we have to make choices. It doesn't always go together. It doesn't always mesh. It doesn't always go with something that is going to make us comfortable. And we need to make decisions, and we need to make determinations of when we're going to allow this part of ourselves to be stronger, when we're going to allow that foundational part of ourselves to be stronger. But it's always an inner conflict. And that is why we find it difficult to sometimes serve as the Or LaGoyim, as the people who give perspective, as the ones who understand Lifkach Einayim Ibros, how to see with the right glasses. I was just talking to someone yesterday, and he said, you know, every time I land in Ben Gurion Airport, when I come off the plane, he said, I feel like I can put my glasses back on. I finally can see clearly. I finally can see what does it mean to live a life with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I feel it every year when we experience Hanukkah. Hanukkah in America is wonderful, and we have an opportunity to celebrate with our families, and we light the menorah, and we have Hanukkah masivas, and we have get-togethers, and it's wonderful. It's really nice. But if you've ever been to Eretz Yisrael on Hanukkah, you experience Hanukkah. You understand what it means to really be in a state of halal v'hudah to HaKadosh Baruch Hu for an entire week. You see a festive atmosphere all around you. It's just something we don't feel here. It's something we don't have. It's something we are lacking. So it's hard. It's hard to have perspective because we ourselves are often very torn about where our own allegiance lies. And this is part of the challenge of the kinds of lives that we live and the experiences that we go through. I think in our generation, at least from what I've read, the one who has put best and really stated most beautifully and most eloquently the understanding of what anti-Semitism is to all of us in every generation was Rabbi Jonathan Sacks. And this is something I've seen in almost every book that I've read of his. I haven't read all of them. He has many, many books. But it's something that has reappeared in every single formulation in every one of his books. He sticks it in somewhere. So if you've heard it before, I think it's worth repeating anyway, because I think he really sums up everything that anti-Semitism is about. And I'm just going to read you one paragraph that he says. This is from his Haggadah, but as I said, he has this in many other places as well. Basically, almost verbatim, the same thing. Anti-Semitism is not a unitary phenomenon, a coherent belief or ideology. Jews have been hated because they were rich, and Jews were hated because they were poor. Jews were hated because they were capitalists. Jews were hated because they were communists. Jews were hated because they believed in tradition, and Jews were hated because they were rootless cosmopolitans. Jews were hated because they kept to themselves, and Jews were hated because they penetrated everywhere. Anti-Semitism is not a belief, but rather a virus. The human body has an immensely sophisticated immune system, which develops defenses against viruses. It is penetrated, however, because viruses mutate. Anti-Semitism continues to mutate. That's what anti-Semitism is in a nutshell. It's a virus that continues to mutate. And that is why it has the ability to continue to penetrate our society and our civilization. It's a very famous comment that Rav Soloveitchik had when Yaakov Avinu has this encounter with Seller Shaleshev, and he has this very uncomfortable conversation with him. And at the very end, he says, Hagida Nashemecha, I'd like you to identify who you are. To which he responds, the Seller Shaleshev says back to Yaakov Avinu, Lamaza Tishalishmi, why are you asking my name? And the conversation seems to end. Now that's very strange. When I'm sitting at the table and I'm having a conversation with someone, when I'm engaging in a dialogue, when I'm engaging in a discussion, of course, it's only natural that I want to know who it is that I'm talking to. You ever been put on a conference call and you all of a sudden you start hearing other voices that you didn't expect to be on there? At least I always stop and I say, one second, who's on the phone? Am I a speaker? Not that I'm afraid of anything I'm saying, but I like to know, who am I talking to? Who's listening to this conversation? Maybe you formulate things differently. Maybe you'll speak differently. Maybe you'll share different information. It's not always so simple. So Yaakov Avinu asks, who am I talking to? Hagida Nashemecha, which is a natural question of anyone who's engaged in any conversation. And the response that he gets seems so inappropriate. Lama Zatisha Lishmi, I'm asking your name because I'm interested to know who I'm talking to. You didn't answer the question. So Rav Soloveitchik wonders, what is this discussion about? And he suggests that perhaps what it means is Yaakov Avinu knew exactly who he was talking to. He looked at the Seller Shaleshev. He identified him. He knew who he was engaged in dialogue with. But the question he asked him was, Hagida Nashemecha, this is going to be the eternal struggle of the Jewish people. I would like to know, do you have a way that you can identify yourself so I can be properly prepared how to go against, how to combat the evil that is going to face the Jewish people in future generations? And he said to him, Lama Zatisha Lishmi, of what value is there? Even if I identify myself, it's not going to help because in every generation it continues to mutate. So it's going to have a new face. Anti-Semitism is going to come in a different form. And every generation is going to have a different kind of challenge. In some generations, it's going to be Hitler, and in some, it's going to be Stalin. And for some, it's going to be communism and Nazism. And for others, it's just going to be all the breakdown that we see today in our civilization. There's no movement that makes us understand how this came to be. But in every generation, it's going to have a different face. And the son of Kalesa turns to Yaakov Avinu and says, Lama Zatisha Lashmi, what is it going to help you? Even if I identify myself, that will not be sufficient for you to be properly prepared in a subsequent generation when you are trying to combat all the evils that will be put against the Jewish people. How do you strategize? I cannot tell you, says the Sarah Shalesa, because as we said, in some generations it will be the Greeks or the Romans, in some will be communism or socialism, Nazism, general anti-Semitism, a just breakdown of immorality that is going to face the Jewish people, whatever it may be. It is always going to be a different formulation. I remember a number of years ago, Rav Asher Weiss was at our home right before Purim. And it happens to be, I was learning the Gemara Maseches Megillah, where the Gemara tells a story about Haman and Ahasuerus. And the Gemara says, there's a mashal to understand the story of Haman and Ahasuerus, which goes as follows. Mashal Abal HaTel Abal HaCharitz. There were two people who lived right next to each other. And one had a big mound of dirt right in the middle of the field. And he didn't know what to do. You can't really plant on the field if you have a big mound of dirt in the way. But in order to remove it, it would cost an exorbitant amount of money, almost not worth it for the amount of money he's going to make on the produce that he would ultimately plant. He had a neighbor who had a big problem in his field as well. The problem there was that he had a very deep pit, a deep hole, thank you, in his ground. And obviously you can't plant if you have that in the middle of the field either. He can't use the tools. He can't use all the instruments in order to be able to have produce coming out. So he didn't know what to do. One fine day, they're both in the supermarket. They bump into each other, and one especially to the other. You know, I don't know what to do. I can't make any money. I have this big mound of dirt and I can't get rid of it. The other one says, it's so funny you say that because I have the opposite problem. And for me to pay to have dirt dropped off in order to fill the hole is going to cost me so much money as well. Why don't we make a deal? I'll come every day. I'll start taking off the load of dirt that you have. I'll start filling my pit. I'll start filling up the hole. And over time, both of us will be happy. Your field will be straight. You won't have these issues anymore. Mine is finally going to be filled in and we'll both be able to be successful. And they shake hands. They make a deal. Says the Gemara, this is Haman and Ahasuerus. Makes sense, right? So I was learning this Gemara, and he happened to look over my shoulder, and he says, so what does that mean? This is Haman and Ahasuerus? What's the punchline? How is this Haman and Ahasuerus? So we read the story, and we basically, on a surface level, we understand it's Haman and Ahasuerus because they were both in cahoots, so they came about it in different ways. But in the end of the day, Ahasuerus seems to be the nice guy. He's just going along with the plan. He had all of the evil intent in mind from the beginning, just like Haman. They were both in this together. That seems to be what the understanding of the Gemara is. He suggested a very novel interpretation that goes way beyond that. And he said, in different generations, there were different perspectives that others had about why they hated the Jewish people. Some said we hate the Jewish people because they are a big mound that we cannot get by. They're so successful. They're infiltrating every aspect of government. They're involved in the highest echelons of society. They are so successful in the stock market. They're doing everything. They control the media. They're doing all the tropes that we've seen today. Everything we've heard. People are claiming that the Jews are running everything, that it's all the Jewish problem, that we're involved, that we're behind the scenes, and all that goes on. And that's why they hate us. There were other generations where they said, we hate the Jews, not because they're so successful, but rather because they're subhuman beings. They don't deserve to be a part of our society. We have to eliminate the Jewish problem because they are a deep hole in the middle of our wonderfully flourishing society. They are a problem and we need to get rid of them. And as a result of that, they come out and unleash their wrath against the Jewish people. Both of them come at it from different angles, both have the same goal. The Baal HaTel and the Baal HaCharitz, however you look at it, they hate the Jewish people. And this is the history of anti-Semitism. This is how it's been, Lama Zeh Tisha L'Shmi, because there is no way to identify it. And in every generation, it's going to be a different challenge that the Jewish people are going to be confronted with. That is the reality of who we are. On Hanukkah, as we know, we just celebrated Hanukkah. We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for all the military victories and all the wonderful miracles that we experienced. But the truth is, when you think about it, we are not a people who appreciate combat. We don't live for bloodshed. We are not a people of war. The aspiration that we have for the end of days, for Yemos HaMashiach, is Lo Yisa Goyo Goycher V'lo Yilmudu Od Melchama. We hope there will be no more antagonism. We hope there will be no more war. This is not what we live for. So isn't it strange? We thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu Al HaMelchamos. We thank the Ribono Shel Olam for the ability to fight wars. Now, of course, we need an army and we need to fight wars. But why do we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu? We would be much happier if nobody had to go to the army, if there would be no conflict, and if we would have no problems. All of us would be happier. So what are we thanking him for? And the Panav Yisharav suggests that perhaps what we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for is the ongoing, continuous, evolving battle of the Jewish people. And we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for giving us the determination, the bravery, the stamina, the perseverance, to be willing to stand up and continue the fight for the values of what the Jewish people stand for. That is something to celebrate. Al HaMelchamos is not the physical battles that we have been through, but rather we thank HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the unbelievable privilege of being the ones to stand up for what we spoke about, Lifkoach Einayim Ivros, to show the world what it means to live life with our kind of perspective, what it means to live life having an understanding that we are a Mamleches Kohanim, that we have that ability to be the people who serve as that link and that bridge between spiritual matters and the day-to-day activities that all of us are involved with. A number of years ago, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Lau was in our community for Shabbos. And it was, of course, a very beautiful, meaningful time with him. But they had arranged on Matzoi Shabbos that he was going to get together with all the Rabbanim of the five towns and their wives, and they made him a Lava Malka in someone's house. It so happened that that Shabbos, unfortunately, was the week of the Pittsburgh massacre in the shul. And it was a terrible tragedy. None of us have heard about it on Shabbos itself. But Matzoi Shabbos, the word got around, and that's the first thing everyone was talking about. And somebody went to break the news to Rabbi Lau and let him know that, you know, there was a terror attack in Pittsburgh in a shul on Shabbos morning. And he was devastated. And he came to this Malava Malka, and he was scheduled to talk about some topic, but he said, I'm so shaken up. Here I am in America. I've lived my entire life believing that this would never happen again. I've become the icon of never again. And here I am in the United States, in the land of the free, in the home of the brave. And the one Shabbos that I'm here in the United States, this happens. And he said, whatever we were going to talk about tonight, we are not going to talk about. He decided he was just going to address the Inyana Diyoma. He was going to address what had just happened. If you ever heard Rabbi Lau speak in his prime, masterful speaker, amazingly insightful, but the drama with which he speaks was, it was and continues to be legendary. I remember being at this Malava Malka. He spoke for, I think, 45 minutes. All he said was one medrash, and somehow it took him 45 minutes, and we were all mesmerized. So I'm going to say it in 5 minutes. But this is the amazing medrash that he shared that I never would have found on my own, because it's not where it should be. I would have imagined that it would be in one of these parshios where Yaakov Avinu is fighting with Sarah Shalesev. If you want to look it up, the medrash is actually by the pasuk of Shar O Chesev O Eiz Ki Yivaleh. Seemingly nothing at all to do with what the medrash is about to share, but it's a fascinating story. So the medrash talks about how a number of murderers all got together and exchanged notes with each other about how awfully unsuccessful their predecessors had been in their mission to murder others. So let's go through the brief history. Who is the first murderer in the history of the Torah? Cain. So what happens? Cain hates his brother. There's tremendous animosity. There's jealousy. They can't seem to get along. Cain says, look, there's one very simple answer, and that is, let me just kill him. I'll get rid of the competition. Sounds like a good plan. What was the problem? The problem was, what he didn't factor into the equation was the fact that his parents were still alive. So long as his parents were alive, they were able to conceive and have another child, and then your competition is back. And in fact, that is exactly what happens. They have another child. What do they name him? Chase. Why? Kishas li Elokim zera acher tachas hevel b'ni. The Torah says they had another child because they lost hevel. Well, we have to bring another child into the world. Well, Cain, now you're back to your problem. So Cain really was unsuccessful in his mission. He had an issue. He confronted the issue. He thought he eliminated the issue, and then it came right back. Along comes the next murderer, and that is Esav. And he says, I too have the same problem as Cain. And I also hate my brother. And he also causes a major sense of uncomfortable animosity with me. And he stole the brachos, and I want to kill him. But Shote Hayakayan, Cain made a huge mistake. Because Cain killed his brother, and then his problem ultimately came back. I have a different plan. We're all familiar with the pasuk. What does he say? Yikruvu yimei Abel avi va'aharga esachi. Now Rashi tells us, it's not what it means. Rashi says he had such derech eretz for his father and such kibudav. I would never kill my brother while my father is alive. I mean, can you imagine what it's going to do to my father? No, that's not what it means, says the Medrash. Another pshat the Medrash says is, he learned from the mistake of Cain. Yikruvu yimei Abel avi va'aharga esachi. Let me wait until my father is no longer alive, and then I'll kill my competition. And this way, there's no possibility of the competition coming back. I will rid the world of the Jewish problem once my father is gone. This way, there will be no possibility of a Jewish problem in the future either. Seems to be a good plan. What happened? What went wrong? It didn't work. We're still here. Along comes Paro, and he says, we too have a Jewish problem. But let us not make the mistake of Cain or the mistake of Esav. Shote haya Cain, v'shote haya Esav, they both got it wrong. Why did they get it wrong? Because what he didn't factor in, Esav, in this plan that he devised was, very nice, you're going to wait for your father to die, and then you're going to kill your brother. The problem is, in the interim period, you waited so long, Yaakov had children, who then got married and had their own children. By the time the right, appropriate moment came for you to kill your brother, he was too big already. You couldn't get rid of him. Bnei Yisrael paru vayishutzu vayirbu. The Jewish people proliferated, the Jewish people grew, and now the problem is insurmountable. Paro says, we're not going to make that mistake. Lahashmid, I'm sorry, he says, kalabein ha'yilat ha'yorot hashlichu. We're going to kill the children immediately. This way, they don't have an opportunity to have children of their own. And then, in one generation from now, we will rid the world of the Jewish problem. Seems not to have worked. What went wrong? Says the Medrash, along comes Haman, who also identified a major Jewish problem. And he didn't know how to deal with it. Well, let's study history. Let's look back at Paro and Esav and Cain and try to figure out what did they do when they had a problem. And Haman says to himself, Shote haya Paro, v'shote haya Esav, v'shote haya Cain. They all got it wrong because the Jews are still here. What was wrong? The problem was, as we say in the Megillah, v'daseyem shonos mikala, which means the Jewish people live differently. They have a different set of laws, but perhaps it means there is one law that is very unique to Jewish communities, and that is what determines Judaism is not the father, but rather the mother. And therefore, Paro, you had a great plan. Let the women be kept alive. They'll intermarry. They'll integrate. All of their children will be Egyptians. There will be no Jewish people. But that didn't work because the Jewish people believe, even if they intermarry, those children will then be Jewish as well. And therefore, Haman says, we have a new plan. Mina'ar ba'adzokein, taf v'nashim b'yom echad. We're not going to wait until they get older. We have to eradicate the world of this problem immediately when a child is born. We're not going to limit it only to the men. We need to extend this and expand it to the women as well. Because if we don't, they're going to have the problem that they'll continue to have children and the Jewish people will continue to survive. That was Haman's plan. Sounds perfect. Where was he mistaken? We're all still here. How can that be? And the Medrash then finally says, we have a tradition that there will be something that we refer to as Melchemes Gog u'Magog. Not exactly clear what that means. Something before the coming of Mashiach is going to happen. Some terrible calamity. Some say it was the Holocaust. Some say it wasn't. Hard to know. But there's going to be some tremendous tragedy before the coming of Mashiach. So much so, the Gemara says in Maseches Sanhedrin, you know, we daven every day, Mashiach to come, Hakale b'chayim shiyavo. The Gemara says there were some Amoraim who davened every day, Yesei v'lo achmine. I hope Mashiach will come, but I don't want to be there. Because I know that there's going to be something terrible that's going to happen before Mashiach comes. So I hope the Jewish people will experience Mashiach. But you know what? Maybe take me before that happens. And I'll come back in Tchiyas HaMesim so that I'll skip that phase, that horrible stage in Jewish history. Something terrible, Melchemes Gog u'Magog. Well, the Medrash says, along comes Gog u'Magog, whoever they are, and they try to identify, how are we going to rid the world of the Jewish problem? We face the same issue that all those who came before us faced. What are we going to do? How do we get over this hurdle, this problem that is called the Jewish people? And the answer is, they devise a plan. You see, the reason why all those before us failed, they say, is because they didn't understand the root cause of the issue. So long as the Jewish people are connected to Avihem Shabashamayim, so long as they have a Father in heaven who loves them and who treats them as the Banim Lamakom, he will never allow them to be destroyed. So all the plans that we can devise will not be successful. We have a new plan, and that is, let us destroy the relationship that the Jewish people have with their Father in heaven. Let us destroy that feeling of connection that they have to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. For anyone who says Tehillim, even if you're not an avid Tehillim sayer, maybe you've started a few times, and you've gotten to the first and second prakim of Tehillim. If you didn't, look later on, you'll look up this pasuk, where the pasuk there says, Ninatka esmos rosemo v'nashlicha mimenu avosemo. That is a reference to Melchemes Gog u'Magog. And what is their plan? Their plan is Ninatka esmos rosemo. Let us take the cable that binds the Jewish people to God himself. Let us destroy it. Let us cut the cord. V'nashlicha mimenu avosemo. Let us throw away those lines of communication that exist between HaKadosh Baruch Hu and his people. And what does the very next pasuk say? Yoshe Bashamayim Yishak, Hashem Yilad Lama. HaKadosh Baruch Hu says it's a wonderful plan, but that is an impossibility. Because our relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu is something that is never going to be broken. Ki lo yitosh Hashem amo v'nachal oso lo yazor. Unfortunately, the Stipler writes in one of his beautiful letters, while it's true that HaKadosh Baruch Hu promises ki lo sishachach mi pizaro, the connection with the Jewish people, the connection that the Jewish people have not only to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but to the Torah itself, is something that will be living on forever. It is not a promise that is made to every individual. It is a promise that is made to the Jewish people as a whole. And every individual has a responsibility and an obligation to make sure that they are going to be part of that promise. How sad it is, when we talk about the Shoah, we talk about the Holocaust, how many Jews we lost to that horrific calamity of Jewish history, of world history. But how terrifying it is that we've lost even more since the Holocaust. People who maybe for no fault of their own have no appreciation and no understanding of what it means to be the Am Segula, who have no understanding of what it means to stand up proudly and be the people who are connected with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to be the ones who serve as the Banim LaMakom. And that I feel, at least in my community, and I'm sure you feel it here as well, is a tremendous challenge that we face with our children. Will they be people? Will they be adults as they continue to grow and go through life experience, who understand and appreciate what it means to be the Yam Segula, to be the Banim LaMakom, to be the people who appreciate Baruch Hu Elokeinu Shebaranu Lechavodo, V'hivnilanu Min HaTohen, V'nasan Lanu Taras Emes. I'd like to read you another passage from Rabbi Sachs, not in the same place, but also this made such an impression on me, where he talks about his grandparents. And he says, my grandparents were not born in this country. Many, even most of the Jews in Britain, had grandparents who came here in the great wave of immigration from Eastern Europe between 1880 and 1914. We are Anglo-Jews of the third generation. It is an almost universal law that inherited wealth lasts three generations and not more. The same applies to inherited Judaism. Ours is the last generation that can still remember a Baba and a Zeta from the Haim with their fluent Yiddish and undiminished Yiddish guide. Ours is the last generation for whom Jewish identity can be sustained by memory alone. The Ger Rebbe once pointed out that the four sons of the Haggadah represent the four generations. The wise son is the immigrant generation who still lives with the traditions from the Alta Haim, from the home. The rebellious son is the second generation who has forsaken Judaism for social integration. The simple son is the third generation who is confused by the mixed messages of religious grandparents and irreligious parents. But the child who cannot even ask the question is the child of the fourth generation. For the child of the fourth generation no longer even has a memory of Jewish life in its full intensity. Our children are children of the fourth generation. Already it is clear that what we took for granted, they do not. They do not take it for granted that they will belong to an Orthodox synagogue or indeed to any synagogue. They do not take it for granted that they will marry. Certainly that they will marry another Jew or that they will stay married. They do not take it for granted that they will have Jewish children or that it is important to do so at all. Nothing when dealing with the fourth generation can be taken for granted, least of all in the secular open society in which even a common moral code seems to be so lacking. That is our generation. That is the challenge that we all face. A generation of Jews who have never seen Judaism in its full intensity, who don't really understand what that perspective is, who don't have that image and that picture that maybe some of us have had from previous generations. They don't feel that. And that is a tremendous challenge. And that is what we all face. As we may appreciate what it means to be a Jew, it is our commitment that we all need to make, that we will make sure that our children appreciate and understand what it means to be a Jew as well. I saw a mashal from the Dubna Magid, and with this we will close. The Dubna Magid writes that there was a Kafri Echad. Kafri Echad, I think, is colloquially translated as a simpleton. Very simple, small-minded person. Didn't really have an understanding of the world. And he's living in a small village, and he has many friends who go on business trips all the time. And one day they come back and they tell him, you know, we saw something absolutely amazing. We went to the big city. You're not going to believe it. But we saw that there is now a wagon that is able to move without horses pulling it, what we call a train. And this man says, how can that be? Are you sure? You checked the horses, maybe they were in the back. No, we checked in the back. You checked in the front. Maybe somewhere in the middle they were pushing it. Maybe there were people. How can it be? This is miraculous. You're not going to believe it. Well, how do I get to see such a thing? They said, well, you have to travel to the big city. Then you have to pay to get a ticket to go on the train. And you'll see. You'll see for yourself. So he saves up money. Again, he's a simple person. He doesn't have big savings. Saves up money. He's so excited. One day, he's finally going to have enough money to go to the big city and be able to see this unbelievable phenomenon that they're describing to him about this wagon that moves without any horses, without any animals. It's amazing. Saves up all the money. Finally, he gets there. And as he's pulling up to the town, he asks somebody, where is this wagon that moves without any animals? And they say, what are you talking about? So they told me it's called the train. So they direct him to the train station. He shows up at the train station. He sees that there are clerks there. People are buying tickets. So he asks, how exactly does this work? Goes up to the counter, waits to his turn. Clerk says to him, well, what kind of ticket would you like to buy? We have business class, we have first class, we have economy, we have, you know, less than economy, whatever it may be. So he says, well, I don't really know the difference. The clerk says, well, how much money do you have? Takes out all of his piggy bank, all of his savings, puts it out on the counter. He says, wow, you have a lot of money. I guess you want a first class ticket. Takes all the money, gives him a first class ticket. Says, all right, the train will be here in 25 minutes. Wait on the platform here. And you'll see everybody will go on the train. That's what he does. He's so excited. All of a sudden, there's a big commotion. The train starts pulling up and he is so overwhelmed. He cannot believe the sight in front of his eyes. And he sees everyone's pushing each other to get in. He pushes his way in, gets onto the train, and doesn't know what he's about to expect. All of a sudden, the train starts moving. He's not holding on to anything. He falls down. He collapses. He didn't know that it moved so quickly. Gets his balance again, stands up, gets into a seat, having a lovely time. And he sees that all these people are talking to each other, and everyone's having a really nice experience. Suddenly, somebody shouts, the Ticketmaster is coming around. The conductor is coming. Okay. So he doesn't even know what that means. Suddenly he sees six people hide in the bathroom. And a bunch of people are hiding under the suitcases in the back. There were some chickens and some horses in the back car. A bunch of people went to sit with all the animals. He can't understand. So he says, I guess this is part of the chavaya. This is what you do. So he also goes underneath the suitcase, tries to hide himself, having a great time. He's laughing. And the Ticketmaster comes around. The problem is he was too tall. His legs are sticking out. Ticketmaster sees him right away, starts hitting him. Who's hiding underneath there? He comes out, says, why are you hiding here? He says, I don't know. This is what everybody was doing. Don't you know there are six people in the bathroom there? There are four people underneath the bench. A bunch of people with the animals in the back. Ticketmaster says, but why are you hiding? Because you didn't pay for a ticket. He says, of course I paid for a ticket. What do you mean? You paid for a ticket? And the people who hide are the people who are ashamed to see me. They're afraid of what the penalty is going to be. Let me see your ticket. Pulls out his ticket. You don't just have a ticket. You have a first class ticket. You're hiding under the suitcases with a first class ticket? Why are you here? He says, what's first class? He tells him, well, you know, in the front of the train, everybody has a comfortable seat. It can actually lean back. You can make it into a bed. You press a button, and any service you want, a waiter or a waitress will come and provide it for you. Any drink you ask for, they'll give you. You're sitting here with the chickens, with the animals, and suitcases hiding underneath in all this filth when you have a first-class ticket. That makes sense? He says, I had no idea. This is my first time. I really didn't understand or appreciate what it's about. The Dubna Magid writes, how often do Jews make the same mistake? We live in a society. We live in a generation where many people are hiding under the suitcases and with the animals in the back, doing things that human beings should not be involved with, living life the way human experience was not made to be lived. And we go along with it because this is the society, this is the culture. And we're all swept up and we're all going along. And the Ticketmaster comes around and asks all of us, don't you realize the price you've paid to be the people who you are? You've paid 3,000 years of Gullus, 3,000 years of Jewish history to be in the place where you are. And with that first class ticket, you're going to subject yourself to sit in the back, to hide underneath the suitcases with all the filth, to sit with the animals in the back of the train and get yourself dirty and give up on the privileges of what it means to be holding that ticket. You are the Banim Lamakom. You are the chosen people. You are the children of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Take advantage. Be proud. Give perspective. Think about it. What does it mean to live life as the Yam HaMitzvah? What does it mean to be a people who were entitled to be the ones who are Mamleches Kohen in the Goy Kadosh? What does it mean to live life being the one who is supposed to be the Am HaNivchar, the poster child for values, for an upstanding lifestyle, for a person who understands what it means to live a life connected with spiritual matters and allowing that to be pervasive in all of the everyday mundane activities that we are all engaged in? That is our privilege. That is our blessing. And perhaps when there's so much rampant anti-Semitism going on in our world, we have an opportunity not to be depressed, but an opportunity to remind ourselves, yes, we are singled out. We are different. We are privileged. We are blessed. We are the people who are given that first-class ticket, and all we need to do is recognize, is pay attention to it, and take advantage of the great gift that HaKadosh Baruch Hu continues to give all of us throughout our experience. I wish everyone a wonderful day. We should talk about happy things. And thank you all once again for coming. Hi. Nice to see you.
My son said to me, when you see my check, you may not recognize him. He's gone with the...
okay.
It's like the insurance like uses his clean shape.
Okay.
Nice to see you.